content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Amy Wentley for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Today we'll start out with an article about Gayle King and her entourage, but Gayle King is featured on Elle's digital cover with her Blue Origin space crew. So this article is going to go behind the scenes of the iconic cover shoot and celebrating their upcoming trip to space. Gayle King is marking her upcoming trip to space in a big way. Gayle and five other women who are part of the Blue Origin spaceflight are on the cover of Elle's latest digital issue, which is unveiled today on CBS Mornings. Alongside Gayle and spearheaded by Lauren Sanchez, the group of women also includes Aisha Beau, Amanda Nguyen, Carrie Ann Flynn, and Katy Perry. Two journalists, a film producer, a former NASA rocket scientist, a bioastronautics scientist, and a pop idol make for a pretty iconic flight, especially since it's the first ever all-female spaceflight crew. The full group had met once before on Zoom, but this shoot for Elle was the first time the six women had actually met in person, and the last time they'll see each other together until the joint spaceflight. This space mission will mark the 11th human flight for Blue Origin's new Shepard program. As Gayle told Elle, going to space has never been a dream of mine. She continued, I was having a conversation with Katy, and she said, well, maybe you need to get different dreams. And I just thought, wow. The crew is scheduled to blast off from West Texas on April 14th. The route is a lofty 62 miles from the ground. For context, planes fly at about 6 miles above Earth, above the Kármán line, which is the point that separates our atmosphere from space. They will spend just about 11 minutes hovering over our planet, so we're sure they'll get some epic photos. Check out the behind-the-scenes video on the Elle shoot below. And you can find that on the Oprah Daily website and read the full interview. Good luck, Gayle, and the rest of the Blue Origin crew. Now we'll move on to an article about lifelong friendships written by Oprah. Even when things are hard, for the truth might sting, we're honest with each other. This week, my dear friend Maria Shriver was my guest on the Oprah podcast. Maria and I have known each other for nearly 50 years, ever since we were in our early 20s doing news in Baltimore. Maria, Gayle, and I met in the summer of 1976 while working at the same TV station. Gayle commuted 45 minutes every day to her family home in Chevy Chase. Maria and I lived in an apartment complex a mile and a half away from work. We shopped at the same grocery store, ate whatever we could afford, and splurged on the crab cakes and home fries the grocer deli was known for. Over the years, we've witnessed each other's successes and sorrows. I was by her side for her wedding, the births of her amazing children, the heartbreak of her divorce, and her incredible achievements as a writer, journalist, and advocate for Alzheimer's research. And she has always showed up for me, no matter what. In 2011, she flew to Chicago to help me send off the Oprah Winfrey Show in style, even though her marriage was falling apart. In my experience with Maria, the key to a lasting friendship is this. Tell each other the truth, even when things are hard, or the truth might sting. We're honest with each other. There's no room for jealousy either, just accepting and loving the person as they are, wherever they are in their journey. We've been friends long enough to get through menopause together. And that brings me to my new ABC special, The Menopause Revolution, which airs tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. She sat down with Maria and some other wise guests, including Naomi Watts, Halle Berry, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and comedian Leanne Morgan. to get really honest about this life phase. Because more than anything, I've learned that the great benefit of riding these waves of change is being able to share what you know with other women trying to get through it. When you learn, teach, Maya Angelou always said. I hope you all tune in, men included, of course. All the crew guys filming this show can tell you they learned a lot. Here's an article from the lifestyle section, and this is entitled, The Future of Travel is Emotional. Tom Marchant, the co-founder of luxury travel company Black Tomato, dares us to ditch the bucket list and follow our feelings instead. For almost two decades, Black Tomato has been redefining luxury travel. Not by offering the lavish resorts or five-star amenities so often prioritized by the industry, but by curating deeply personal and emotionally driven experiences for its clients. As an antidote to perfunctory bucket list travel, the company has built its philosophy around the pursuit of feeling that we find while traveling, but not in our everyday lives. Travel can feel transitional, but Black Tomato co-founder and luxury travel expert Tom Marchant is determined to make travel as personal as possible, one experience at a time. Here he shares insight into his company, the industry, and the transformational impact of travel. You've built Black Tomato around the idea of emotional travel. How did that concept first come to life? Why did you choose to categorize experiences by feelings as opposed to destinations? And Tom's replace name is Tom, isn't it? Let me just check back up here. Yes, it's Tom Marchant. That's my husband's name. You think I'd remember it. So anyway, here's Tom's answer. In the beginning, many of our friends and colleagues didn't know where they wanted to travel, but they knew how they wanted to feel. There are lots of destinations and things to do in the world, but travel hadn't quite been brought to life in a way that focused on feeling. Even before we started the company, we would go off in pursuit of feelings and emotions. When we launched the company, we didn't list any destinations. Everything was categorized according to emotional need. It was a totally different way of looking at it. It was also in the days when the word experience was not nearly as ubiquitous as it is now. Oftentimes, our job is to ask that people are asking of themselves. It's almost like being a therapist. Some other companies make it quite easy by going for a short-term sale. With us, we like to ask our clients what it is they're really looking for. What place will make you feel inspired, feel challenged? As such, the pursuit of feeling has always been a part of our DNA, because in life, whether through travel or not, emotional well-being has become super important. How exactly does your pursuit of feeling platform work? What role does AI play in shaping your travel recommendations? Our whole idea is that your travel and your body keep the score. We've been working on our Pursuit of Feeling platform for a long time. There, we've created many travel experiences and sorted them according to key emotional categories, being revitalized, challenged, contented, or distracted, for example. You can interact with and search these categories in a really interesting way. In terms of AI technology, AI has become the language of business, hasn't it? Our whole goal here is to enhance the customer experience. We want to celebrate the best of our human insight and passion. Our AI tech can smooth the process. It pulls from our own data, from our own trips and insights, so it's not something that's going out into the vastness of the internet and gathering random information. We call it our feelings engine. You can have a conversation with our AI about how you want to feel on your trip, and it'll come back to you with suggestions and direct you to an experience that will best embody that feeling. And then, of course, we'll put you in touch with our human experts to bring it all to life. You've spoken about travel as a form of self-discovery. Can you share a personal experience in which travel allowed you to shed personal and societal expectations? Our customers don't necessarily want to go places just because people are talking about them. It's with the rough and ready stuff where you're going to have the best memories, the best experiences, and the best lens into a place. I remember being in Delhi once, and my guide kept asking where I wanted to go. I said, just take me to where you would like to go, okay? At first, he pulled up outside the Oberoi Hotel, and I said, no disrespect, but no thanks. Then we ended up going on this rickshaw right into the guts of old Delhi. There's this tiny hole in the wall with clay oven cooking and the best tea in the world, and it's where his mother's best friend had been working for decades. We just sat there together. It was dreamy. This is what people actually want, regardless of level. A feeling of discovery, of living like a local. It's so lucky to be able to dip into the world and see it as it is. And there's so much more reflection in a place like that than, say, a fancy restaurant or a hotel. I know we're all very fortunate to have those restaurants, but they tend to blur after a while. You could be anywhere, you know. Many travel experiences today can feel overly curated. How do you ensure that the trips you design retain an element of spontaneity and genuine discovery? About 5 years ago, we launched a service called Bring It Back, which was the creation of a series of inspirational itineraries. This service was where you would travel and spend time with different communities just to get an alternative take, from nomadic tribes in Mongolia to entrepreneurs in Iceland. And you bring everything you learn back home, even if it's something you didn't necessarily agree with or something that would challenge your view. When we think about wellness, it's often very personal. I've always been a big believer of Maslow's hierarchy of needs and was looking at the way you journey through those needs, especially with self-actualization, what you know, how you feel fulfilled, and the values within yourself. It's not defined by others. Travel is a wonderful vehicle to answer questions that you might have about things that are fundamental in your day-to-day, but you don't really get a chance. It might be a relationship or health or love or business, but it's hard to find the answers, except when you travel. You can so often find inspiration from others. When we launched Bring It Back, it was well received, but I think we're still catching up. We're always looking for growth, looking to be challenged, and it's possible to lose sight of what travel can do for you beyond letting you recharge and relax. So, beyond letting you recharge and relax, what does travel really do for you? Ego dissolution travel, when you feel invisible in a culture, is amazing. I often talk about the pursuit of anonymity. You're not important, and it's great. In fact, it's one of the best things in the world. I remember before I started Black Tomato, I was working in Warsaw. There, I saw people wearing these hats. Baker Boy caps. This was before Peaky Blinders got popular, and I really liked them. I started wearing that cap around, too, and no one looked at me twice. It was great. Then when I came back to London and wore it around my friends, they all had such a strange reaction, so strange that I didn't quite have the courage to keep wearing it. That all said, travel gives you a chance to do new things, to learn and be inspired, to allow your barriers to come down. In other words, it gives you permission to be yourself, even if that's as simple as wearing a Baker Boy cap. We always aspire to lead our customers to a place they want to be in anyway. It can be hard to find a way there without guidance. People can miss out. There is always a better or more profound experience to be had, but travel is not always about epiphanies or transformations. Some of the best things I've had while traveling are the things that have scared me in the moment. It's about the things that challenge you, that overwhelm you, that are unexpected to you. It's about the whole range of feeling. Let's go to culture and news now and look at book reviews. The title of this book review is, I wrote about my grandmother's abandonment, and then my family abandoned me. By putting her family's non-secret on the page, Alyssa Altman broke an intergenerational cycle of shame, silence, and false perfection. Her relatives weren't too happy about it. Every family has a core legend, a cone, a defining, foundational, sometimes cryptic narrative around which its generations are coiled. Just for your listeners, for your interest, the title of this book, which would be important to you, is called Permission, The New Memoirist and the Courage to Create by Alyssa Altman. So every family has a core legend, a cone, a defining foundational, sometimes cryptic narrative around which its generations are coiled. Left unresolved, it will pop relentlessly back to the surface like a rubber bath toy. It is the story that appears when we least expect it. In primary relationships, both successful and failed, in parenthood, at work, in recovery meetings, in the patterns that our therapists tell us they see. It is an endless loop, a thin Mobius strip that vibrates like a guitar string. This is mine. My paternal grandmother was a comely, frosted hair, thick-browed, elfin woman who left her Central European country in 1900 when she was two, who cared for me and saved my life when I was deathly ill as a teenager, who padded across her linoleum-floored Coney Island kitchen in gold vinyl ballet-style slippers every morning and night, who had been a child prodigy making a town hall appearance playing Chopin when she was 14, who played half and a dollar poker, who had a salty, ribald sense of humor, who loved to laugh, who had a tiny gambling addiction, who made a nice brisket and a decent chicken and matzo balls as heavy as lead weights, who lit Sabbath candles every Friday night, and who, when my father was three and my aunt eight, almost centuries ago, abandoned them. This non-secret, secret, touched all of us through the generations, whether we hid it or not. No one escaped its epigenic grasp. It formed and shaped us and altered our emotional landscapes, our outlooks, our sensibilities. When I was a young child in the 70s, growing up in a community where dour-faced neighbors walked our streets with Auschwitz and Dachau numbers tattooed on their forearms, I heard older Jews call Polish the language of death and Yiddish the language of survival. In our case, the lexicon and abandonment became the sound and rhythm we knew and still recognize today as familiar. The undertow of maternal rejection flowed through every conversation, every argument, every family gathering, every threat. If I acted out as a teenager, my mother threatened to leave like my grandmother had, or to change the locks and throw all my possessions down the incinerator. My grandmother's leaving resulted in my father's lifelong insatiable need for security and love and sustenance, as did mine. My grandmother's leaving resulted in my aunt's lifelong insatiable craving for perfection, beauty, and safety. My father metabolized his experience through the constant telling and retelling of the tale of his mother's leaving to me like a myth, as if to make sense of it and codify it. "We don't love you anymore," she said, and then she walked away. No one else in our family spoke of this non-secret secret, but I inherited it and the need to make a sense of it in the way I inherited the color of my father's eyes, his sense of humor, his temper, his quickness to tears. In 2012, 10 years after my father's death and 20 years after my grandmother's, I wrote a book that traced my own cravings and addiction to the table and relentless need for sustenance and safety to my father's fear of abandonment and my grandmother's leaving. My book was a simple love story, a linear narrative about meeting the woman who would become my wife after being single for a decade, coming out as queer later in life at 34, and moving from New York City to rural New England in the days before September 11th. And in an 8-line paragraph towards the end of the book, I wrote of my grandmother's leaving and her eventual return. It was June. My youngest cousin, the handsome groom, shared our grandfather's, his great-grandfather's name. I presented him with our grandfather's massive cantorial prayer shawl, which had been passed along to me by my father. The rabbi wrapped our grandfather's shawl around the bride and groom's shoulders. The groom stepped on the glass. Another cousin leapt from his seat to gingerly collect the shards in a linen napkin and have them encased in a solid block of lucite to preserve the moment when the glass shattered, symbolizing the fragility of life. During the meal, I rose, wove through a throng of guests, and walked down a long, empty corridor to the bathroom. I heard high heels clacking on the linoleum following me, a hand on my shoulder. "We did not give you permission to tell," a cousin said to me as I turned around. She was seething with anger. She backed me up against a cinder block wall and checked to make sure we were alone, looking over her right shoulder and then her left. She bent down so that we were eye to eye and tapped her finger against my breastbone. "We did not give you permission." We had loved each other very much. For a time, we'd been as close as sisters. And then we weren't. "But you did it anyway. We did not give you permission. It was not your story to tell. You don't own it." I didn't breathe as she spoke, inches from my face. "We don't love you anymore," she said, and then she walked away. Who gets to tell a particular story? To craft it? To make it public? Is it an ethical question? A moral question? Is it a question about ego? We all know this person. The one who takes over a conversation that's already underway because his version of the story is he feels the only one. Again, humans are invested in being right, even when they aren't. This is how wars are started, be they in the bedroom, in the boardroom, in Congress, on the battlefield. Stories are inevitably owned. I must be right and you must be wrong, and I get to say whether you can tell the real story. In politics, it is called controlling the narrative, and in public relations vernacular, spin. Entire teams of people are assembled and paid for by governments and elected officials to control, to own a narrative. At its most benign, spin is a game of he said, she said. At its most insidious, controlling the narrative can be weaponized in the most familiar and horrific ways. The happy indigenous American who welcomes the pilgrims, the happy slave who willingly submitted to their master in the American South. The Nazis knew this when they told their story that Jews had horns or flat heads or they were vermin. They convinced enough people of the story, and the people believed them. The keepers of those well-crafted stories are never happy when the truth is finally revealed at long last. After experiencing abandonment because of writing a story about abandonment, I had finally come to understand what it is that makes our species so profoundly attached to permission and story ownership. It is a manifestation of control and creative hierarchy designed to keep people in their places with the threat of shaming, which is perhaps the most ancient and biblical of ways to keep people in their place. And it is not to be confused with guilt. Guilt, according to Brené Brown, means I did something bad. Shame means I am bad. What comes out of shame? Self-loathing, self-hatred, self-flagellation, the certainty that our creative lives are doomed because if we're that bad, then why even bother? Shame says that we must hide ourselves like Adam and Eve. Shame caused our fall from the garden. Shame demands that we must hide our stories and the very essence of who we are. In the telling of my family's story, a 23-year-old immigrant and new wife walks out on her family one day and doesn't return for 3 years, and it impacts generations into the next century. I revealed a deeper truth. My family was profoundly human and flawed after all. But perfection is a dangerous myth, a cloak woven of fears of inadequacy and ostracism and self-loathing. Perfection is the emperor without the clothes. It demands that we be something other than who we are for the sake of someone else's reputation and cultural acceptance, both of which have nothing specifically to do with us. Perfection causes generational and systemic destruction, and, in the words of Anne Lamott, will keep you cramped and insane your whole life. Telling the truth where false perfection once existed, casting shade and doubt on it, results in humanity, empathy, and compassion, and sometimes trouble. And again, this was an excerpt from the book entitled Permission, The New Memoirist and the Courage to Create. That's by Alyssa Altman, and it is available $28 at Amazon. So, that's your book. And we will now move to lifestyle and relationships. Is your family toxic? Here's how to know if it might be time to cut them out of your life. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Some lucky people are born into families they love spending time with. Their close bonds make holidays and multi-generational vacations a drama-free joy. But for others, simply seeing an incoming call from a parent triggers anxiety that dates back to childhood, and they leave family gatherings feeling hurt, angry, or exhausted. Toxic family dynamics can have a far-reaching impact on our lives as adults. That said, it can be tricky to recognize when you're in a toxic situation, and even trickier to figure out how to navigate it. Here are signs of a toxic family member and expert advice on dealing with a toxic family, because drink all of the wine is not a sustainable plan. One of the biggest signs of toxicity is the inability to take any kind of accountability, shares Morgan Pommels, MSWRSW. A parent, sibling, or other family member may often place blame for anything that's wrong on someone else, you included. While their actions or behavior may not be the sole reason for a given issue, refusing to take any accountability is a red flag. That lack of accountability, per Pommels, is rooted in an attempt to displace and offload somebody's shame or bad feelings about themselves so they don't have to apologize. Conversely, the ability to apologize, to own your stuff, is a hallmark sign of a healthy family system, she shares. Another common sign is passive-aggressive behavior, said Pommels. This can include guilt trips, backhanded compliments, or subtle jabs and digs that no one in the room actually calls out, she says. It can even be nonverbal, like rolled eyes or a disapproving sigh. No one has known you longer than your family has, which means they have a rich back catalog of personal failures to draw from when commenting on your life. Even if they insist they're just teasing, those comments may, subconsciously or not, be disseminating by design. My clients often struggle when parents use the concept of FOG, fear, obligation, and guilt, to try to get their child to act a certain way, says Pommels. This manipulative behavior can be anything from intimidating you, threatening you with punishment, or guilting you by saying something like, "You're not a good kid if you don't like this." Being subject to these sorts of tactics can make you feel hopeless, powerless, and full of dread, and, as is the design, can make you do or say things you're uncomfortable with. Setting healthy boundaries is crucial in healthy relationships. It can range from something simple, such as "please don't call me at work," to asking other family members to respect the rules that you set for your kids. If someone else doesn't think the boundaries apply to them, they'll breach them. And that's a blatant show of disrespect. A term inspired by the 1944 Ingrid Bergman film Gaslight. Gaslighting is a form of emotional abuse in which someone causes the victim to doubt their own understanding of reality. In other words, your family will deny that any abuse is actually happening, whether it's a sibling insisting your childhood experiences weren't as bad as you remember, or someone point blank saying that did not happen. You're making things up as usual. This is where being in a community, fostering healthy relationships with people, and finding a therapist is really important, says Pommels. It's not until someone really mirrors that gaslighting behavior back to you that you can hear that it's not an appropriate response. They use threats, harsh language, or violence. And this may seem like the most obvious sign of a toxic relationship, but not if it's always been normalized as part of your family dynamic. There's never any situation in which name-calling or physical intimidation and other forms of domestic violence are justified. And if you fear for your safety, help is available. Dysfunctional family dynamics warp your whole sense of self-worth, says Pommels. If you grow up in dysfunction and can continue to live in it, it can feed these beliefs that you aren't good enough and that people don't really love or care for you and never will. You may also find yourself seeking out relationships that reflect the same dynamics and dysfunction. You might find partners who treat you the same way or who demonstrate some of those qualities that your dysfunctional family demonstrated because it feels familiar. It can be hard, especially in the absence of physical or financial abuse, to recognize that a relationship is dysfunctional. But a hugely effective tool, said Pommels, is getting more in touch with your body. Your body is going to be the thing that says, "I didn't like that," or "this doesn't feel good," or "I don't actually want to go to the family dinner," she says. Instead of repressing or ignoring, get in touch with the sensations of your body. If there's a tightness in your chest, you can't breathe well, you're physically shaking when you're on a phone call with your parents, take note. How to be slippery. Some parents or family members are constantly looking to bait you into conflict with hurtful words. Pommel recommends acting as slippery as possible. In other words, practicing short, evasive, and noncommittal responses to these upsetting comments. Even just saying something like, "that's interesting," or "cool," works. Anything where you're not getting caught up in friction, she says. Notice that it's not an attempt to change anyone's behavior, but rather to control your own. When to repair and when to let go. It's a hard decision to cut off contact with your loved ones, but Pommels points out that certain situations require it, especially when previous attempts to improve relations are unsuccessful. While it can be hard to draw an indelible no-contact line, Pommel recommends going no contact if there is flagrant physical, financial, and/or emotional abuse. At that point, no contact is probably necessary, she says. But it does have to be a decision you come to on your own, or it simply won't stick. Deciding to enforce a no-contract rule is a big move that may test your resolve, call for new family holiday traditions, and spur other family members to try and intervene. Certainly not the sole option for every turbulent family bond, nor is it the right option for everyone. But it also doesn't have to be permanent, especially because dysfunctional family systems can be repaired. There needs to be a third party, says Pommels, whether that's a trusted community member or a family therapist you can connect with. With toxic families, it's so easy to get swept away rather than sticking to what actually needs to happen in order for there to be repair. Radically accepting. If you don't want to entirely cut off your family, then it's important not to only manage your expectations, but to be radically honest with yourself about who your family is. The biggest piece is acceptance, says Pommels. We're not looking to go there and change the system. Instead, we're just trying to get through the day. It's certainly not easy, but radically accepting allows you to be present for the moments of joy that can come with family, rather than being angry, resentful, or trying to get your parents or siblings to change. Next, we are moving on to work and money. These five hiring myths are sabotaging your job search. Superstar career coach and veteran human resources leader Madeline Mann reveals the real reasons your application isn't standing out and how to reverse the search so that employers are coming to you. When I was leading the human resource department, oh, and this is written by, just so you know, that's Madeline Mann. Yeah, I said that in the intro there. Okay. When I was leading the human resource department at a growth stage technology company, somewhere around the 1,000th job application I reviewed, it dawned on me that most job seekers need some serious help with how they present themselves in the job search. While some unlikely candidates blew the hiring team out of the water, compelling us to hire them, many perfectly qualified candidates struggled to barely get past the first interview. Like a DIY psychology researcher, I started to track my own data points, and I began to see clear patterns of what led job seekers to repeated success or guaranteed failure. Job seeking can feel like such a nebulous process, especially after the clearly defined rules of school. It's time to unlearn the habits we have built and start seeing the job search process through the employer's eyes. For years, I have heard job seekers state the same false assumptions over and over again about the hiring process. Working in human resources and as a career coach, I know these beliefs to be patently false and damaging to those who hold them. Myth number one, it will be easier if I aim lower. It is a tremendous misconception that if you are not seeing traction in your job search, that you should aim for a job that is at a lower level. You think, heck, they've got to want me, as I am a super qualified person for this role. This will be easy. And then you get even fewer interviews than before. Landing a position lower than your level is very challenging to do. That's because companies are more afraid of hiring someone overqualified than they are of hiring someone who doesn't quite have all the qualifications but could learn on the job. They don't see it as a plus to have someone with X travel experience. They're looking for someone to do this job, not for someone to get their foot in the door and then ask for a promotion or salary increase within months of joining. Hiring takes an incredible amount of time and money, starting in the interview process and extending to new employee onboarding. Depending on the type of role, there are estimates that it may take an employee 6 to 12 months to be fully productive. With that in mind, it's easy to see why the company does not want to hire someone who is treating their role like a placeholder until the actual job they want comes along and they leave the company. Unfortunately, overqualified candidates frequently prove this stereotype right, so most companies don't want to take the risk. Myth number two. I need to get another degree or certification to stand out. I have never seen a hiring manager make a final candidate decision based on degrees and certifications. The thing about formal education, that it's a check-the-box qualification. If a company values and expects a certain degree or certification, it is likely a baseline qualification that most of your competition will have as well. Now, I won't tell you to skip buying a degree if your dream is being a brain surgeon or the next Judge Judy. Even I wouldn't trust a self-taught surgeon. And I also am not going to deny the allure of having a certain pedigree on your resume. Some consulting firms, for instance, tend to recruit predominantly from certain MBA programs. In those cases, having that brand name degree matters. But for the vast majority of jobs out there, doing anything beyond the minimum education qualifications will not help you stand out. Myth three, the job search is a numbers game. My client, Nestor, came to me with a master's degree and great transferable skills as a researcher, but had applied to 500 jobs without landing a single offer. Nestor's situation is common, though. Many people apply to hundreds of jobs before landing an offer, and many people giving career advice online encourage this, telling followers to apply to dozens of jobs every week. But let me tell you a secret. The job search is not a numbers game. If it were, Nestor would have landed his job by applying online. In the era of online applications, companies are now completely inundated with resumes and cover letters, most of which are the equivalent of spam in your email inbox. They are submitted by job seekers who likely haven't read the job description and are completely unqualified. When I asked recruiters at top tech companies how many of their hires come from online applications, they reported hiring only 10 to 15% of their workforce from that source. I spoke with a recruiter for a top streaming service who said that the number of applications would get so overwhelming to sort through that she would sometimes skip applications altogether and start searching on LinkedIn for the professionals with the right skill sets for the roles she was hiring for and simply invite those people to interview. This isn't unique to that company. Many organizations with desirable or highly specialized roles employ dedicated sourcing teams to find the right candidates themselves instead of wading through the digital slush pile. Nestor decided to embrace the art of job shopping rather than the practice of job searching. He shifted from casting a wide net to carefully curating his job pursuits. The result? Interviews at one out of every three places he was interested in. Ultimately, he secured his dream role in a different career as an organizational development specialist with a $35,000 salary increase. One of the key attributes to job shoppers is their focus on a low-volume job search. As a job shopper, you do not apply to hundreds of jobs like Nestor did at first. Instead, you focus on a small number that actually match what you are looking for and land interviews at many of them. Myth number four. I need to stay open to many types of roles so I don't miss out on potential opportunities. Back in my recruiting days, we once opened applications for an executive assistant position. I came across an accountant who was interested in the role, and I extended her an interview since I understood that her transferable skills could make her a good assistant. But in the interview, it became clear that she hadn't thought much about this career change. I asked her, accountant to executive assistant. That's a big career change. What steps have you taken to be sure that being an executive assistant is the right role for you? She responded with, well, this interview, I saw the job description, thought it sounded interesting, and so I took the call to learn more. This is the last thing an employer wants to hear. This leads to a pretty quick rejection from the employer's side because they do not want to take a chance on hiring someone who isn't sure if they want the job. Essentially, showing that you're open to many different roles sends up major red flags to employers that you will be difficult to retain. And honestly, it's not worth the challenge. Myth 5. Things will eventually become clear and it will all work out. Among unsatisfied professionals, there's a recurring theme, the belief that someday, a mysterious day in the future, things will miraculously change and they'll stumble into the perfect job or career. At the same time, they typically do little to meaningfully alter their current situation. They don't like their job, so what do? Head to job boards and search for roles with a similar job title, hoping the universe will sprinkle a bit of magic on their career if they just hit the refresh button in a different department or company. Efforts like this make professionals feel like they are doing something, when really they're just setting themselves up to take a new role and quickly become just as disenchanted as they were before. It's like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. It might seem like progress, but it's still the same old sinking ship. You've got to completely switch up your approach. If you keep playing the same game, you'll win the same prizes. And this excerpt was from Reverse the Search, How to Turn Job Seeking into Job Shopping by Madeline Mann. And now to beauty. And this is in a category called Women Who Start Things. Genius in a Bottle, How a College Dean Turned a Passion for Her African Culture into a Skincare Brand by Holly Carter. Nikonye Iwerbon is a woman intent on fostering cultural connections. A prime example, she once searched LinkedIn for others who shared her name and reached out to all of them. And in her job as Dean of Admissions for a prestigious university, she guides students from around the world on their academic journeys. I get to interact with future leaders from all walks of life and in all fields, says Iwerbon, who grew up in Lagos, Nigeria. There has always been something within me that wanted to do something that relates to my culture and highlights my heritage. That vision became reality in 2023 when she launched the beauty brand Any Culture, that's E-N-I, space, culture, C-U-L-T-U-R-E. She's poured her heart and soul into the company, which currently produces one hero product, the nourishing Safi Revitalizing Face Oil. The name Any, derived from her initials, her middle name is Nikonye, is a play on the word any and meant to convey the idea that anybody can benefit from wisdom and culture of Africa. I want to elevate Africans in Africa and create a beauty brand that speaks of luxury, quality, and effectiveness, says Iwerbon. Here's how she did it. I grew up in Lagos, Nigeria, and came to the U.S. for college, and then went to law school here. I go back to Nigeria somewhat regularly to visit family, and every time I leave, I feel this deep sense of nostalgia and crave things that make it home for me. The music, the art, the people, the food. I grew up with both allopathic and traditional medicine. For fever, we would have herbs. For a rash or sore muscles, we would get massages with jelly butter. Later in life, as my skin started to show signs of stress, I started looking for the same kinds of pure and wholesome products I used as a child. I realized a lot of the skincare in this country is filled with synthetic ingredients I didn't recognize. So I researched ingredients. I researched the ingredients that I was familiar with from my childhood. The idea for Any crystallized for me when my mother was visiting. She brings her own little pharmacy with her, and moringa is one of the things Nigerian people use medicinally for physiological problems and for the skin. In that moment, it occurred to me that this was an opportunity to marry my cultural heritage with a remedy for skin issues. Laying the groundwork, I truly wanted to understand what traditional African medicine means and how it's applied. So I researched by reading articles and books and talking to my family members. A lot of people rely on traditional medicine, sometimes in combination with modern medicine, because one, they believe it helps, and two, it's affordable, and three, it has been used over and over. I wanted to understand the property of these ingredients and why they are much more potent coming from the African continent. So I traveled not just to Nigeria, where my family is, but also to Ghana, because they are very much part of the vanguard of promoting African beauty and skincare. I wanted to see the oils being pressed and the butter being made and to just understand culturally how this worked. I decided that it would probably be best to produce the products here in the U.S., at least initially, while sourcing some, if not all, of the main ingredients from parts of Africa. Striking oil. I call the Safi Revitalizing Face Oil African Magic in a Bottle. It's intended to nourish skin, reduce the appearance of fine lines, smooth, soften, and boost collagen production. It has 10 ingredients. The idea was to keep it as simple as possible, to leave in what was needed and leave out what wasn't. The result is a lightweight oil that absorbs pretty easily and quickly into the skin without leaving a greasy residue. At the heart of the blend is moringa oil from the moringa tree. I get the moringa and passion fruit sea oils from a cooperative in Rwanda. Known as the miracle tree in parts of Africa because it is just generally for good health. It contains vitamin A and vitamin C, 7 times more than in an orange, more potassium than a banana, and 4 times more calcium than milk. It's also full of antioxidants, which is really good for your skin. Moringa is in and of itself a superfood. But I think all of the other ingredients in combination, both the traditional and the modern, make it especially potent for preserving and improving skin health. The goal. One is to create a company and a product that is great quality and that's also highly effective. Another is to foster an appreciation for Africa and the goods that come from there while creating an understanding that these things can be universally applied. Ultimately, I want it to be a celebration of African culture. Overcoming challenge. I'm laughing because everything about starting a business is hard. I think the hardest part is continuing to believe in yourself, continuing to believe in the product, and believing in the purpose. Because everything we tell you, not necessarily people, but things we tell will tell you that this isn't going to work and you need to stop. There's so many hurdles with funding, unanswered emails and calls, deadlines and filings, updating your website. All these things that you need to do, especially as a solopreneur. The message you get, the feedback you sometimes get, is to just give up. That makes it hard. But the counter to that is believing in oneself and the product. What you set out to do is really the antidote to whatever it is that may feel hard. And success breeds success. Yes, I'm going to have wins along the way. And with each win, I'm motivated to get to the next one. More often than not, it's just one step at a time. And that's what I'm going to have to do. A defining moment. It was when I received an order from a person I didn't know. Initially, you send messages to your friends, and people are supportive and nice, and you get orders from them, and that's great. And then one day you get an order, and you're like, how did this person find out about it? The other defining moment is when there are repeat orders. The road ahead. I have ideas about the kinds of products I might want to bring to market, but I also don't want to jump too far ahead. I really want to continue along this path. I want to continue educating people by growing my market share with this one product. I also want to explore other traditional ingredients that can benefit all kinds of people. I'm just excited to talk about and elevate African culture. I use the word Africa generically, but of course it's 54 different countries. I am proud of myself and that I have done all these things in my life. And at this stage in my life, I'm 54 years old. I still have the ability to pivot. I have my day job, and that's a lot, sure. Parenting is a lot. But I have proven to myself that I can make things better. And once you have a will, there is definitely a way. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Amy Wentley, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.